everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's June 2023, and this is episode 345, which is a conversation about Christian ethics and corporate diversity outreaches and marketing and corporate sensitivity training. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. John Ferrer, who is a content creator for Cross Examine Ministries and a teaching fellow with Equal Rights Institute. John has an MDiv in apologetics and a THM and PhD in ethics and philosophy of religion. He is married to Christian apologist Hilary Ferrer of Mama Bear Apologetics. John has written a special feature-length article in our upcoming 46, number one and number two double issue of our print journal. His article is called How to Keep Your Job Without Losing Your Soul, a Survival Guide for Diversity Training. And you can only read his article in our special double issue with a partnering gift in June to the Christian Research Institute. You can partner with us at equip.org. And if you listen to the break, you'll hear more about this very special issue. Now, I do want to note, because we have gotten some feedback from our listeners, that we do not have the ability to control the ads that are played. We do select which kinds of ads that can be played on our podcasts, but sometimes other ads are inserted instead of the ones that we have chosen for our content. So we have heard feedback that you might be listening to some ads called Can't Cancel Pride, which will be a little bit ironic when you listen to this episode, but we just wanted to give you that heads up since we have gotten feedback from our listeners. Now, on to the podcast. John, it's good to have you on again.
It's good to be here.
Well, John has covered a very, I think, provocative topic for us, but one that is really on the minds of everyone right now, because I mentioned, of course, it's June 2023, and June, as we've seen in terms of every corporation that we're coming into contact with, is Pride Month, and how Pride Month is, in at least in America, how it is in the West, celebrated mainly for LGBTQ and queer folks is in June. So we are going to be talking about this specifically, as I said, in the context of his article, especially for people who are Christians and thinking about their Christian ethics and work in corporations where they're having mandatory corporate diversity and sensitivity training and how that they can survive that. But before we talk about that, I just want to talk about how actual customers of corporations are coming in contact with this. And as I mentioned, John wrote a piece for us in the print edition of the Christian Research Journal that's coming out soon. And how are we going to handle this ideologically charged corporate training? Because there's a lot of controversial corporate diversity efforts that are being placed upon employees, but also placed upon customers through specifically, I'd say, progressive LGBTQ sexual ethic ideology. And so there's been so many examples that have come up in the news, it's really hard to keep up. But I want to ask John about these three, because it's very fascinating to me, just kind of some of the evolution of how this marketing has gone. But let me just highlight a few of them and ask John about them. First of all, people are watching the news, the professional baseball team, the LA Dodgers, honored a organization called the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence and gave them a Community Hero Award before one of their baseball games. And this group defines themselves as the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence are a leading edge order of queer and trans nuns. And what they actually like to do is impersonate and mock Catholic practices and beliefs, the Roman Catholic Church. But through those different campy routines that they have, they like to promote an LGBTQ sexual ethic. And also, the LA Dodgers have been honoring different gay groups for the past 10 years publicly at games. And then the second one really blew up on the internet, and that is that Bud Light, Anheuser-Busch, used a TikTok star named Dylan Mulvaney, and he has almost 10 million followers. And over the past years, Dylan has chronicled the journey on his TikTok account to become a trans woman. I didn't look at his account. Maybe he goes by she now. And so, but he still says Dylan Mulvaney. So Dylan creates this TikTok video and he promotes this Bud Light beer complete with cans of, you know, picture of himself, herself printed on them. And it just really kind of blew up the internet. People were talking about it. And also, lastly, Converse sneakers had a whole set of Pride commercials. But what I found very interesting in those commercials, so they had different members from the queer community just talking about what it means to be queer. And really, it wasn't a focus on the shoes at all, because I guess people know Converse are shoes, but it was basically them stating their queer sexual ethic, what they liked about being queer, what it meant to be queer, and the celebration of that. And at just at the end, it was the Converse logo. They were wearing some Converse shoes, but most of the time they weren't even showing shoes at all. They were just showing these particular people speaking about what it meant to be queer. And so I think that's really interesting, from like LA Dodgers doing something for 10 years to Bud Light looking to a TikTok star, and now Converse promoting, having commercials where they're promoting this ideology and not even really promoting their shoes per se.
So there's a lot going on there. I think the general impression I'm getting is that this growing rainbow wave of social activism merging, fused, tangled up in corporate America is a new behemoth that compared to what we're used to. Unnerving, it's strange, it's disorienting. I'm sure there's plenty of people out there who are cheering for it, who align with those ideological goals. But there's a lot of moderates who are like, just sell the product, quit trying to sell an ideology. And then there's a lot of opponents who are like, I don't agree with that ideology. I deliberately disagree. But the more this kind of ideological corporatism spreads across America, the fewer options you've got for goods and services if you're just going to get by in life and go about your day. If the only big box store you've got in town or mega mart you've got in town is Target, and you're trying to not support progressive ideology, then tough. Target's pretty committed to that. If Cracker Barrel, Chick-fil-A are some of the more recent ones, Kohl's, you mentioned LA Dodgers, Bud Light. And I think part of what's so disorienting about it is it seems like for baseball and beer, it's very counterproductive for them to yoke their product, their service with an ideology that their average consumer, their average fan isn't really committed to. And it's kind of offensive and off-putting to them. But that's where you have to kind of pull the curtain back and dig a little deeper and see how the free market isn't as free as it used to be, even just 20 years ago, and how that's changed the way goods and services are marketed and the way they're offered. And the Bud Light scenario is just a great illustration of what happens when a corporate entity is trying to appease competing customers, and they're ending up killing themselves in the process, because the boycott against Bud Light has been one of the more effective customer responses. And frankly, I think if baseball fans were to do the same, then you'd see a lot of these corporate entities rolling back their activism and say, hey, hold on a second, we still have to make a dollar. You know, we might be appeasing other customers at a higher level, in the sense of trade partners, advertisers, the banking customers, and so on. They might be trying to appease those folks, but if they don't have a service that they can market anybody, because no one's buying at the base level, then those other customers won't matter. You can get all the loans you want, but if no one believes in your product anymore, then it doesn't matter. And so the LA Dodgers, you mentioned how they had this Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence sort of drama comedy group come forward, and they had an honorific ceremony for them. I think it was about an hour before the game started, and the stadium was empty. There were more people outside the stadium than inside. That is the protesters protesting that. And yes, the Dodgers have been doing that for years, but the groundswell of opposition to this stuff has been growing over that time, because people are starting to realize that the capitalist outlook out there is increasingly crony capitalism, and it's kind of owned by a lot of progressive agendas. And they're just tired of all of the force-fed rainbow feast that's being shoved down everybody's throats. And so even though that may have been going on for years before with the Dodgers, I think the opposition is growing as people are realizing they're waking up from the waking nightmare that is a lot of the quote-unquote woke ideology. And so I think you're seeing right now some of the reaction to that. You also mentioned Converse. Converse is acting consistent with what they think is their best interest to appease their corporate level customers, and to make sure that they've got good standing and good scores so that they're allowed to do business at the upper level. But they still have to keep a product that people will buy. If they can't make that product something that people want, something that people are willing to pay money for, then any other customers at that upper level, it's immaterial, because they don't have a service anymore. If they don't have a service or product, then they aren't really competitive economically. So they're trying to kind of appease two different kinds of customers there. And they're using an advertising strategy that just relies on brand appeal rather than actually informing people about the product. So they don't necessarily say our shoes are made of this better fabric, you can jump higher, you'll have a cushier sole. It's not any of that. It's trying to create associations with the right party politics so that they can get those corporate deals, those advertising deals, the sponsorships and things like that, that can swell their bankrolls. And in theory, they can translate that into the products and goods that they provide. But again, if people aren't buying, if people boycott it, they can really push back against this behemoth.
You will not want to skip through this break at all. You are going to want to listen to the whole thing, because we have a big announcement. And that announcement is, after almost 45 years as a print magazine, this issue that I'm talking about, volume 46, number 1 and 2, in which John Ferrer's article appears, is going to be the last print edition that we will ever have. But it's not the end of the Christian Research Journal. In fact, all of this great content that you have enjoyed in our pages, if you've been a subscriber for many years, all this content, the Christian Research Journal, is going online, and we are morphing into an online magazine. But not only that, there is no paywall. There is no paywall for online exclusives. Absolutely everyone can access our content that you hear about on the podcast and read the articles and reviews and all the different essays that we publish. But I did want to say that, you know, it's been a great 45 years. Of course, the founder of the Christian Research Institute, Walter Martin, along with our late editor, Elliot Miller, founded the journal in its print incarnation, and it used to be the Christian Research Newsletter, and it became the Christian Research Journal. And it's been a highly regarded and highly awarded, and I think dispassionate voice in Christian discernment and apologetics for many decades. So it started out back in the 80s as a newsprint format called The Forward, and then we later in that decade kind of upgraded it to a glossy magazine. But as you can imagine, publication costs have risen over time. And we, every time we just thought, should we cease the print journal? Because many print magazines, even in mass market secular magazines, have ceased their print edition more than a decade ago, maybe 15 years ago. And we battled these trends for many, many years. But this is our last print edition. But again, the good news is that all this intelligent, clear-thinking content and our essays and articles from the Christian Research Journal lives on online at equip.org. So don't go anywhere. You're going to get everything on our website, and it's going to be for free. And really what's driving some of this is that we, as you know, if you've been a donor to the Christian Research Institute, you've been hearing about how we believe it's to
very critical to equip the church worldwide, specifically in the 1040 window. And if we think about most of those folks, they cannot afford a subscription to the journal. Plus, airmail postage is really exorbitant. So you know this if you've ever gifted a subscription to an overseas missionary or church staff overseas. But I really think that most people want to hit the website, they don't want a paywall, and they want to read these articles because then you can continue to share them widely and broadly and email them, tell people about them, text them to people, put them on your social media pages of all your favorite episodes and articles, and it's going to be available to everybody. So with all that, this is not goodbye at all. I feel like this is just beginning to give you more of this great content that some of you have enjoyed for more than 40 years. But I want to say a big thank you to our listeners and our subscribers and our partners. And really, from the bottom of our heart, on behalf of CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, all of the staff members, our entire editorial team, and every single contributing writer that we've published over the years, we want to say thank you. Thank you for your support, and thank you for your continued support as we move to an online magazine. And now, back to our conversation with John Ferrer.
Well, another example I want to ask you about is Target. You just mentioned it briefly, but you've done a lot of writing for us on the subject of Satanism and the occult. We've covered it here on the podcast. Now it seems that the Minnesota corporation Target is offending people on both the fronts of the pride emphasis as well as Satanism. So help us understand what the big brouhaha was with Target and their pride display. Now, I did go into Target looking for the pride display. It was there at my local Target, except for it was, I don't know if it was more prominent at the front of the store in other places, but at my store, it was kind of in the back. I thought they might have even taken it down, but it was actually in the women's athletics section is where they placed it, complete with journals for being queer. They also had clothing items for girls as young, or children as young as five in five toddler sizing. And they had a whole bunch of different queer related baking products and all the different kinds of things in the athletic women's workout area. But I did not see any of these other products supposedly associated with Satanism. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
So Target, leading up to Pride Month, which this year you have the perhaps the strongest developing swell in this brand of capitalism, which we'll talk about later, I'm sure. I'm trying to figure out how much to say here, but prepping for Pride Month in hopes of expanding their brand. Basically their grade that they would get as a brand for higher level corporate type customers. They have this strong LGBT emphasis display that was more T than LGB, if that makes sense, because they started having a lot of cross-dresser and trans-identified friendly clothing. So tuck-friendly women's outfits, so women's swimwear, that was made so that if you don't have female genitalia, but you've got male genitalia, but you want to wear female swimsuits, they were marketing tuck-friendly swimsuits so that you can reorient yourself down there and still fit as a man, even though you've got different genitalia. And Target's been doing this kind of things more subtly for many years now. I myself began boycotting Target right around the Obergefell decision in 2014, because that was the growing debate about bathrooms, and Target was coming down on the side of you can go into whatever bathroom you identify as. And I looked at that and said, that's a huge disservice to women and children, and I can't support that. And I stopped rolling with Target back then. And it's a soft boycott. I've shopped there maybe twice in the last 10 years. So I wasn't surprised that Target was going to have a bigger Pride emphasis this year, because all the signs were saying, prepare for this month. It's going to be the biggest Rainbow Fest you've ever seen this month in June, which is Pride Month. Well, sure enough, they didn't disappoint. They had this huge LGBT display that was much stronger, not just on gay and lesbian, but and bi, but on trans identification, which is a lot of lesbian, gay, and bisexual people who aren't part of that train. They don't support all the trans activism that's starting to kind of take over LGBT. Well, they didn't just do LGBT. They didn't just have a lot of rainbows, but they were marketing to kids. And that was especially offensive to a lot of customers. So people that hadn't been following Target for the last 10 years were surprised to see this huge display that was intentionally set up in the front of the stores and was put there at first to be as prominent and flag-waving, pride-oriented as possible to win that kind of social credit for it. But they didn't account for, they didn't anticipate the degree of pushback they would get. Because a lot of their customers are moderates and conservatives or liberals who are like, well, keep it to yourself. And so they got a lot of pushback and a lot of conservatives were swearing to boycott the place. Well, Target responded with a meeting within the first week of putting up those pride displays. They had an official meeting and it was declared. It wasn't deliberated. It was declared you're to take these displays down in many areas. And then the areas that they stay up, I don't know if they left any up front, but for those that they let stay in place, they moved them to the back of the store so they wouldn't be in such a prominent place, wouldn't be in an eye-catching location that's going to attract parents and kids just because they happen to enter the store and couldn't miss it. Now you have to go searching for it a little bit. But that's where Target was after that first meeting. Well, of course, by changing their stance on it, they got a lot of blowback from the progressive left, the radical left wing. And so they started getting boycotted. And so the delightful irony is that Target was getting boycotted for offending conservatives and strong liberals alike because they didn't pick a stance. Well, as folks were digging into this story, because it was just rife with all sorts of headlines, it was just a really interesting dumpster fire, you might say. Well, as they dug into it, they realized that to come up with these displays and to come up with some of the items that they were selling, they partnered with a gay and queer designer named Eric Carnell. When I use the word queer, that used to be a term of derision. That's instead become a term that much of the LGBTQ have adopted themselves to mean not binary. Gender queer means you don't identify as male or female, you're queer. Or sexually queer would be, I don't identify as gay or straight, I'm undecided, I'm queer. So this gay, queer designer, Eric Carnell, he had been running, I believe, their Instagram account for almost a year, or at least contributing to their Instagram account for a year. And he designed a lot of the products that they provided. And when folks dug into this, they realized this guy has all the markings of the satanic temple kind of Satanism. He had references to Satan, to pentagrams, to Ouija boards, witchcraft, and militant activism about this LGBT lifestyle. Those are all themes worked within his design line called abprolin.co. I believe he's based in London, England, but abprolin.co. And if you go there, which I don't encourage you to, but if you were to go there, you'll see a lot of very disturbing pink and purple themed imagery talking about how Satan loves gay people, witches are for the LGBT, and you'll see backgrounds with Ouija boards and pentagrams, not to mention all the aggressive militant activism that has come into fashion in the last 2-3 years regarding LGBT. So that's the connection to the Satanic Temple. I couldn't find any formal statement by Eric Carnell identifying himself as a Satanist, but he has the markings consistent with it for whatever that's worth. So I'm not saying he is a Satanist, but a lot of the messaging he puts forward is consistent with that. And the CEO of Target, Brian Cornell, seems like he hasn't learned his lesson at all, at least since his quote as of May 23rd. He said, "I think these corporations are just good business decisions, and it's the right thing for society, and it's the great thing for our brand." He also says, "I know that focus on diversity and inclusion and equity has fueled much of our growth over the last 9 years." And if you think about it, 9 years ago would have put them just after the Obergefell decision, which was the big gay marriage decision in the Supreme Court. And back then, people were saying, if you allow gay marriage, you're stepping onto a slippery slope that's going to end up with a lot of more complicated, messier, uglier things. And that's exactly where we've rolled down to in recent times. But Target was trying to get on, in their view, the right side of history and support LGBT and LGBT activism early on. And that's where they're at now.
So a lot of people, including consumers, of course, are watching what it seems to be this really big shift in the corporate world. And they're struggling to connect the dots. In other words, Pride has started years ago, but it seems like this year in 2023, Pride emphasis corporately is much bigger than ever. And for example, I was at Walmart this past week and I went to go buy a makeup product that I always use. It's stuff to clean makeup off my face, actually. And I was surprised that all the bottles of this makeup remover were replaced with, and in fact, the most popular size, you know, was replaced with bottles, and all the labeling was Pride. Just everything about it. I don't know if there was a QR code on it, but it was all there. There was only a really tiny bottle or a giant, you know, like kind of refill, very expensive bottle without this Pride labeling on it. And I thought that was just interesting. And this is why I want to ask you about some of this, because it's affecting us, even ones that don't have explicit Pride efforts like Walmart. They are carrying this. So on top of this label, it says, "Remove your makeup, not your pride," and all the Pride rainbow. And then there's a QR code. And I guess if you do that, I didn't, I guess I should have, you know, done the QR code to see where it took me, but there's a QR code to take you somewhere. And then they also say on the front that it's really big letters, it's cruelty free, and it's also vegan. So can you help us understand why it seems that every major corporation is embracing diversity and pride, and not just that, just like environmentally safe things and all these things? And then I know you started talking to us a little bit about some of the characteristics of ESG, which is, you know, you talked about the different stakeholders for corporations. And so can you kind of just unpack all of that? Like, why is there this big shift? And what is ESG? And how does that include not just customers, but other entities that make up how a corporation, especially if they're one that has products to sell, impacts the marketplace?
So I've got a theology and philosophy background, and a lot of the nature of this beast that you're poking at right now, that we're poking at right now, is in the realm of finance, economics, and so on, which is not my area of specialty. So before I start going into my understanding of what's going on here, I want to recommend the book Woke Inc. by Vivek Ramaswamy, who is currently one of the primary candidates for the Republican Party. It is very eye-opening, the nature and extent of corruption going on right now to create these too-big-to-fail kind of entities that defy a lot of the popular wisdom about how trusts and monopolies are bad. They're bad for free markets. Big players can force out all the smaller players and determine the rules and then make it so you don't have a free market anymore because they ran off all the competition, and then they can skyrocket the prices. They can mistreat their customers because there's no competition to hold them accountable. That's the problem with monopolies and trusts. And essentially you have big players in this multimedia internet age, this tech age, that are operating kind of like that, but it's they're kind of occupying that economic space that has kind of been invented in the last 100 years or 150 years. So one of these, you might call them waking monsters, because they've got this, I dare say, wokeness tie to them, but the effects are very monstrous. One of these waking monsters is, you might say, big finance. So groups like BlackRock and Vanguard were announcing years ago that they're going to use their influence and their multi-trillion dollar organizations that determine who gets to invest with who, who's allowed to invest, who's allowed to partner up, loans, and all of that, all sorts of money transactions. The corporate customers I was talking about earlier are in many ways big finance. So big banking, mutual funds, and folks like that. So these big players, big finance, were announcing 10 years ago that they are going to use their influence to shift the capitalist sphere from shareholder to stakeholder. Now, that might sound like we're just talking about people with vested interests, who has a share in the company, who has a stake in the company. But the actual effect of this shift is drastic, because shareholder capitalism would have been anybody who has a share of the company. And it generally translates into make sure your company's profitable. Make sure you're taking in more than you're dishing out. Make sure you're generating wealth and your shareholders will be happy and you can stay in business. Stakeholder capitalism is an attempt to spread beyond that and say each corporation has a duty to be socially responsible, which sounds great. We think we don't want corporations to be wrecking the environment, to be destroying families, killing their workers, no health care plans or benefits. We don't want them to be that kind of abuse of the early industrial age era. We don't want that from our corporations. But here's the problem. A lot of very savvy, largely left-wing players recognized some loopholes there that they could exploit, so that stakeholder, instead of just a shareholder, is going to allow governments, it's going to allow other corporations, it's going to allow bigger business that's bigger than yours to determine what you get to do by giving you a score. And that score is your ESG score. This stands for environmental, social, and governance. So how good does your company do at taking care of the environment, being environmentally conscious and responsible? How good is your corporation at taking care of social needs within your sphere of influence? And how well do they govern themselves? So this ESG score, if you've got a high ESG score, you're allowed to play ball. If you've got a low ESG score, you're not allowed to play ball. And that means Vanguard or BlackRock or one of those players like that might say, I'm sorry, your corporation has to get their ESG score up before we're going to allow anybody to do business with you. And I'm not talking about ground level customers. I'm talking about if you're with Coca-Cola, Vanguard or BlackRock can tighten the screws and say, we're going to make sure that there's not a professional team out there that allows your Coke products to be served in their stadiums. We're going to make sure that there's not a bank out there that's willing to hold your funds, because we're going to make sure that it's more beneficial for them to blackball you than to cooperate with you. And so they can use their trillions of dollars of influence to make any given corporation comply with whatever their environmental, social, or governance goals might be. And you can imagine, just looking out at the rainbow wave that is taking over this country this past month, you can imagine what some of the key goals socially are. It's going to be LGBT activism. Environmentalism, you can imagine, it's going to be climate change. And governance, it's going to be about bringing more ethnic and racial diversity, less ideological diversity, but more ethnic and racial diversity into your, and gender and sexual diversity into the higher ranks of governance in your organization. And so this is the big finance waking monster. I talk about it a lot in the article, so I encourage you to read it there. But besides the big finance monster, there's also the big tech monster, which we've seen I'll rush through this just with a good example because we've seen it just play out and unfold as Elon Musk bought out Twitter and then made all of these secret discourses public between government actors and Twitter, which were effectively censoring free speech and restricting people who had a voice and they had a place on Twitter and saying, no, you can't do that. And they're kicking people off their accounts and they're labeling as false and fact-checking things as false that are actually true and trying to control the narrative through Twitter. The same thing's currently going on with YouTube, same thing's currently going on Facebook. And effectively what this means is that big tech in their own way can use their social media influence and their technological influence, think Google, think all the spying information that can happen through cameras and through voice activations and things like that. All of that is information that can be sold to the highest customer. And there's a lot of ways around it because this whole realm of technology is worlds different from the kind of industry and the industry correctives that we had to prevent abuses of power, you know, 50, 100 years ago. So all of this stuff has outpaced a lot of the legislation out there so that they can do most anything they want as long as they're creative about it. So big tech has the ability to sell this kind of data, sell this kind of access so that they have privileged access and new markets, say in China or in India or in the Middle East. And so big tech and social media, and then of course, mainstream media, these are all spy for hire type of organizations that are allowing big players with money to dictate what narrative is going to be the accepted narrative for that particular platform. And I mentioned mainstream media in passing because a lot of mainstream media is downstream of some of these bigger big tech and big finance decisions. Nevertheless, a lot of mainstream media is still kind of in bed with the far left. And as long as they are providing cover for bad decisions like Bud Light, like with Target and 100 others, as long as mainstream media is providing cover, they can kind of suppress the groundswell of opposition so that this farce can continue a little bit farther. That, I think, describes about four of the big waking monsters we're dealing with right now in this new corporate landscape: big finance, big tech, big countries, and mainstream media.
So in that same vein, can you explain to us what the corporate equality index is? As I mentioned, they're kind of trying to cover all the bases at Garnier for that makeup remover, because not only was it branded Pride, but it was branded that it was, you know, vegan and had these great ingredients and cruelty free from animals and all these kinds of things. So what's the corporate equality index? Because it does actually, you know, it sounds technical to us, but it does reach us at the consumer level as we see branding.
Yeah, that's a good pointed question. So I had mentioned ESG, environmental, social, governance, and that's a scoring system used to determine how these different corporations rank in terms of their not directly economic influence in society. And you have to have a good score to be allowed to play ball. Well, one of the main metrics used to evaluate your social score on the ESG is your corporate equality index. This is something used that it's devised to evaluate how effectively your corporation is implementing diversity, equity, and inclusion throughout the company and in the way it presents and markets and sells its products. Often, this is the make or break issue. Imagine an exam or a test you're taking. So let's say you go back to school and you're going to get a law degree and you've got a test, a final exam. And on your final exam, you've got 40 multiple choice questions worth 1 point each. And then you've got one essay question worth 60 points. The corporate equality index is the essay question. It's that big make or break issue that in many ways determines what your ESG score is, and that is going to determine whether you're allowed to play ball economically or big finance is going to put the screws on you and force you to comply through punitive measures, blackballing you, blacklisting you, and things like that. Now, Corporate Equality Index has gotten a lot of attention through Woke Inc. by Vivek Ramaswamy. James Lindsay has been talking about that. He's been ranting on it for at least about a year now. But there's not just a Corporate Equality Index. There's also a Healthcare Equality Index, which does the same thing and helps explain why a lot of hospitals are risking lawsuits for the equivalent of child abuse by trying to enter the market in gender transition surgery for minors, which is a very risky thing, medically speaking, legally speaking, and ethically speaking. It's very difficult. If you've seen what these surgeries do and how they work, you know this is literally explicit harm to the individual doing it. Now, we could perhaps justify it by saying adults can do what adults want to do. But when it comes to minors, you don't quite have the same medically informed consent because they're minors. And if parents give consent, then that's parents participating in child abuse with the medical industry as their instrument of abusing their children. And so that's not really helping the case there. But why would hospitals be, to the extent that they are, lining up to offer these kinds of surgeries? Because there's a healthcare equality index, and they still have bills to pay, they still have services to offer, and they still have sensitivity to the market. And if they're not allowed to move freely in the market with respect to their healthcare industry, then they could go bankrupt. And they have self-interest motivating them to play ball with this rainbow coalition. There's also a municipality equality index, which is going to be like city level. This would explain why some of your police cars in some cities have rainbow flags on them, so that this city is allowed contracts and banking favors and approval by big finance because they are improving their social score for their municipality equality index. And there's also a state equality index, which is probably not as explicit and overt because states are operating at a slightly bigger level, that they are a little bit more immune to this, but not entirely. So that's what's going on with the Corporate Equality Index. And hopefully with some of these insights, you can start recognizing what's going on out there when you notice your favorite brand of pizza or your go-to restaurant or your service industry or your place of employment, why they're doing the things that they're doing. It seems like everybody's racing to virtue signal about LGBT sympathies. It's similar to back during the George Floyd riots, how everybody was racing to showcase just how sympathetic they were to BLM. A lot of it is just virtue signaling and not very sincere and not very deep. And as soon as it's not profitable for them anymore, they'll drop it like a bad habit. A lot of the rainbow coalition we're seeing is just a thin veneer for good old-fashioned cronyism. Not capitalism, classically speaking, because we're not talking about free markets. We're talking about pressures and controls trying to restrict the free market so that it's not free anymore. We're looking at cronyism where folks out of self-interest are trying to appease their corporate level and financial level customers so that they're allowed to pay. So they're paying them off effectively so that they can play ball and then stay in business while all the smaller and mid-level businesses are crushed under the weight of it all because they can't risk marginalizing their customer base the way a Bud Light could or the way Target could, because they can take a big hit for a couple of years, maybe even declare bankruptcy, reallocate things, and then come back years later and survive. But your average mom and pop shop can't do that. They're just done for. They'll lose, you know, six figures and just be out of business. Well, big businesses have a vested interest in making sure that little businesses don't stay in business and keep competition up. And that's, I think, where we're at. The Corporate Equality Index has all the markings of good old-fashioned cronyism.
Well, I want to ask you a little bit more about this aggressive social activism, because I said that I didn't go and QR code, but I did go on the website for Garnier, which I told you this is makeup remover. At the very front of their website, on the main banner at the top, it shows this makeup remover and it says Garnier's partnership with Heritage of Pride, and they're proud to support their mission for a future free from discrimination. Well, on the front, nobody wants to discriminate against anyone. I think Christians would say that they're against discrimination. But when I click to learn more about this, it is definitely, I mean, it is pages and pages and pages, not just about their product, which is this micellar water makeup remover, but how they give us history on the gay movement all the way back to the Stonewall riots. They have a whole piece on Harvey Milk. It is quite, I mean, it's almost like a little educational panel after panel after panel. And then they say, we are proud that Pride does not end in June. We celebrate Pride 365 days a year. Of course, that's right above the fact that they also are committed to greener beauty with vegan products and cruelty-free products. So most people might not know, well, what does Garnier do? They do various different hair color stuff. And then also they have a popular shampoo brand called Fructis. Now, they're sold mainly in big box stores like your Walgreens, CVS, and Target, and Walmart. So the average customer picking up a Fructis favorite shampoo, because it's inexpensive at Walmart, doesn't realize that what they're doing or what Garnier hopes that they're doing is to support Pride 365 days a year. So that's just kind of interesting after you've talked about the corporate equality index. So it seems to me that corporations, you know, it seems like a different kind of approach to marketing than and what they're doing, corporate, you know, relations with customers and other kinds of things than 15 years ago, even. So it's gone quite quickly. I mean, they've always tried to, you know, play to their base customers and use different social cues and value messaging of their product to appeal to this primary customer, you know, and in the past we've had generic social messaging. I mean, back in the 80s, you know, Coca-Cola, we are the world. And there was kind of some of that, you know, free to be you and me stuff in the 70s. But it wasn't a particular worldview more that comes across as a political partisan message. In other words, a lot of things that were done marketing wise were supposed to basically be embraced by everybody, no matter your political stripe or whatever your beliefs were. It was something, oh, I can support that, you know, Coke is the real thing or something like that. But now, just with my example of Garnier, like you go on their website, I mean, you got to do a few clicks to get to the products because they're giving me a whole history with just that one click of the banner of the entire gay movement going on for pages and pages. It seems quite aggressive with this activism that seems to me to be politically one-sided and almost like a religious preaching. I mean, if we got on and any company had something like that about Christianity and Christian ethics and all that, I mean, people would be up in arms. And so this seems almost like an evangelism to me. And then we mentioned earlier at the beginning of the podcast with the TikTok trans guy, Dylan, and Bud Light, it just seems like, wow, we're going to go after people who aren't even our major base because we have to be seen as an ally. And that's really the message that I hear, that we all need to be allies to this particular sexual ethic in order to be good citizens or something. So, you know, people have spoken out about it. People decide to cancel their Dodger season tickets and things. But everywhere I turn, I've seen companies going in that direction. And even companies like Walmart, I mean, people go to buy these products at their stores. They're not going to stop. And while they don't celebrate Pride per se, they can't not start the Garnier Pride line. I mean, there it was in Walmart. So what's changed? Yeah.
Well, so corporate America has basically the same motivations they always have. Cynically, you can say the only three motivations that would explain any given crime that you stumble upon as a crime scene detective would be sex, money, and power. And for corporate America, because it's made up of people, it's going to have the same kind of motivations. When you peel away all the nuanced layers on top of it, it's still sex, money, and power. But being the economic side of things. It's going to be more money and power than the sex part. Sex is going to be more instrumental for getting more money and power. But that said, there are larger top-down pressures demanding that corporations prioritize different customers than they, you know, we might think of them prioritizing. We might think of them like Bud Light prioritizing the average Joe Schmo who buys a case of beer before the ball game. We would think that's their target audience. But there, any given corporation is going to have partners, organizations that do shared marketing, that do shared services. They set up shops beside each other because they have complementary businesses. They have to have venues that are willing to sell their product. They have to have banks that are willing to hold their money and grant them loans for new adventures. They have to have R&D departments. They have to have favorability so that their company is allowed to do promotions to get new recruits, to get access to qualified and upper-level recruits for upper-level positions. So they've got layers and layers of customers on top of that base level Joe Schmo buying a case of beer before the ball game. And all of those customers, they still have to serve. And if there's a trend in a lot of their corporate level customers, then they have to adjust to that trend. I was mentioning stakeholder and shareholder capitalism. Klaus Schwab, famous of Schwab, is one of those big players who wrote a book called Stakeholder Capitalism, basically declaring this is the move that the capitalist world is making, to where you now have to focus on the broader influence of your company. And that's got to include social, environmental, and governance level things that reflect where we want to see the world going. I'm not going to extrapolate too much on why and the what behind all of that at Klaus Schwab's level. But I do know that when you keep scratching, when you keep digging underneath, you find Marxism as a key influence behind a lot of this stuff. I've started listening to a lot of James Lindsay's work, and that's really what he's been doing, is identifying all the different ways that Marxism has snuck in and found an influential presence in different areas of the modern world. But one of the characters that James Lindsay attributes a lot of this to is a guy named Herbert Marcuse, who argued that capitalism, Marcuse was an out-and-out socialist, but kind of the new Marxist type, not the old school, because he was trying to see what Marxism, how it needs to evolve to keep up with where things are going now. And he looked at capitalist countries and said, they're flourishing. It's working well enough that people are content with their material prosperity, which if Marx was just an economist, then he wouldn't have been all that anti-capitalist. But Marx wasn't just an economist. He was a theologian. He saw a different future for humanity. He wanted to enable a different future for humanity that didn't have the limitations that were part of or built into capitalism. But Marcuse looked at capitalism and said it works well enough, but that good enough is the enemy of the best. And so in true Marxist fashion, to install a utopian future, a Marxist utopia, they had to break up the complacency that the benefactors of capitalism feel. They're not going to join their Marxist revolution when, you know, they've got food on the table, they've got a roof over their heads, they've got a good job, and their family's secure. Why on earth would they want to risk all of that and go march in the streets with some Marxist revolution? Well, Marcuse hatched a brand of socialism, a new brand that he saw as more marketable in Western countries, where instead of demonizing corporate America and demonizing capitalism per se, they looked at that and said, the real enemy, the deeper enemy, isn't corporate America so much as it's the holders of power. And this is how old school Marxism differs from, you might say, new school Marxism. The power isn't just economics. It's not just money. Old school Marxists would have been focused on economics. New school Marxists are spreading that concept, not just from money, but to other loci of power, which would be whiteness, which would be masculinity, which would be straightness, normal gender, ethnic majority status. You know, all of those things are locations of power that need to be busted up and redistributed so that you can have a more egalitarian and flourishing future. So how does that translate into the corporate world? Well, instead of demonizing corporate America, you weaponize them against these concentrations of social power. That's what we're seeing. Instead of just a simple demonization of eat the rich, it's more like, let's get the rich on our side so they're leveraging their influence, their product, their millions of dollars, their billions of dollars. They're leveraging that into a marketing campaign that's going to force feed LGBT ideology or critical race theory ideology or climate change ideology. It's going to force it down our throats, so that everybody who's picking up on fashion and following trends will drift this way naturally, and everybody who's opposed to it will be frozen out of the system because there's not a bank that's willing to hold their money. There's not a business willing to hire them. And that's the direction that Marcuse was foreseeing capitalism needs to go under the influence of Marxist players. And I think we're seeing a lot of that going on in corporate America today. But I attribute a lot of this to James Lindsay. He explains it a lot better than I do. And Vivek Ramaswamy in Woke Inc. I recommend those sources for people that want to find out more about this than I could explain here in this podcast.
Well, this is a really deep dive that we did because we're now just getting to the main part of the article, which is diversity training and for the employees. But I think we had to give this backdrop as to where corporations are, why they feel that it's important to have diversity training and sensitivity training and require employees to go through that. So as kind of an education, and especially new employees too, and then educating longtime employees. So where does diversity training for the employee fit into all of this?
So in many ways, diversity training in the corporate world has all the hallmarks of re-education camp. It's just reformatted from government re-education to corporate and schools being pressured by non-governmental forces to re-educate their employees, their staff, their customers, so that if you want to be able to play ball in the future, if you want to be part of the future and not be sidelined, then this is the ideology you're going to have to get in line with. And in corporate America, it means you can be passed up for promotion if you don't attend this diversity training and sign your support for this diversity statement at Cracker Barrel or at Pella Corporation or at Vermeer or at Target or Coca-Cola or Converse or any of them. You have to attend these diversity trainings that are supposed to teach you not just, this isn't just sensitivity training, mind you. Sensitivity training was, you might say, an early form of this that was framed around the newly discovered threat of sexual harassment, which has probably been going on forever, but we became more aware of it maybe in the 80s or 90s. And so they would have sensitivity training to bring their staff up to par so that they're not going to get a bunch of lawsuits for sexual harassment. That's what sensitivity training was. And there was a gender diversity element that corporations needed to account for so that men weren't acting like chauvinist pigs around female employees. And so that kind of makes sense, but we're not just talking about sensitivity training. We're talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI. And these are all code words. Don't take any of them at face value when someone uses them as if it's common knowledge and tries to get you to accept what they're saying. Ask them what they mean when they use those terms, and then keep pressing it till you get to concrete, tangible stuff instead of vague platitudes. Because diversity, equity, inclusion, in short, means a lot of contemporary progressive ideology. It just has code words so that they're not saying we want people to support a non-normative future that doesn't have gender norms, queerifying gender distinctions so that, you know, every child is born gender neutral and they get to determine for themselves what they want to be. Traditional marriage doesn't have any priority over gay marriage. That's kind of one of the implicit things that a lot of DEI ideology carries with it. Now, I'm not saying every DEI course that a business offers is going to include all of that. They're going to be very diverse across the spectrum. But when those terms come up, when that the implied ideology starts to be smuggled in, I have to encourage anybody who's in that training, don't sign anything that you don't knowingly, and after finding out exactly what they're saying, don't knowingly support. Don't sign it. Be reluctant to sign anything because that will be used against you or will be an embarrassment or a shame to you later when you stand before the judgment seat. Also, if you can avoid those trainings, it's probably better to avoid it. If you can't, and sometimes there are circumstances where you really don't have the leisure to, do everything you can to keep your convictions. You're not signing anything. For the most part, shut down. Don't interact in ways that are going to encourage and make it look like you support or endorse things that you don't. There's an ethical element here. And when we recognize that this probably is, in many ways, re-education camp for the Western world, you're going to have some strong minds and you're going to have to know your Christian worldview so you don't get deceived. Frankly, a lot of the church isn't prepared for that. And they will come through that believing some wrong idea or some dangerous ideology because they didn't even need to be re-educated. They were educated into something because there wasn't any baseline that they had for a defense of historic Christianity as it regards to marriage, traditional gender, the Imago Dei, biblical anthropology, and basics of what a human being is, where gender and race fit into there. All of that could be taught responsibly from a natural law and from a biblical perspective beforehand, but frankly, a lot of Christians don't have that in place, and they're pretty ready victims to be re-educated into whatever that contemporary ideological fashion might be.
So that's some advice that you're giving to employees that have, especially work for these larger corporations, and they...
And smaller.
And they have to deal with this corporate activism. But what about if it gets to be very specific, like in order to be employed here, you have to sign this document that says that you will support and participate in all of these different diversity outreaches that we have. How should new employees or even old employees, sometimes they'll be like, hey, we want all the employees to sign this, you know, kind of like back in the day, the non-disclosure NDA kind of signings. But this one has to do with our diversity focus at our corporation that we want you to be supporting and participating in.
Oh, that's tough because I'm reluctant to generalize over a lot of these things where folks don't have a straightforward option. Sometimes you have a straightforward option. Sometimes, in many cases, I just say, don't work there. Quit. Call up the news media or call up your church or broadcast it in social media. Embarrass any corporation that is trying to force you to believe something you don't believe that doesn't have anything to do with the product, doesn't have anything to do with the service. That is objectionable. And there's a legal case to be had against it, but very possibly that corporation, that business, small, medium, or large size, is liable to have a better lawyer team than you have. And so they could probably still win in court 9 times out of 10. Fortunately, there are some pro bono forces out there that would be willing to take a case if you're being forced to violate your conscience for the sake of employment, because there is some legal protections on the basis of religious freedom. But don't assume that will work in your favor. Some states that would work, whereas other states it wouldn't, because you're probably not going to get a favorable justice in some of your West Coast states to where you could get a fair hearing anywhere shy of the Supreme Court level. So that's one of the real challenges you have to face. You might also be able to look at that statement and maybe they watered it down a lot and you could agree with it. That's something you have to be very discerning and very careful about, but do not sign it until you know exactly what you're signing. Because if you're signing something you don't believe in, you're lying. And you're encouraging other people to lie by being part of the crowd, part of the trend. Because a lot of what's going on in diversity training is not about diversity. It's about conformity. If they were seriously concerned about diversity, they would be encouraging the free market of ideas and free speech, not just superficial diversity of skin color and ethnicity. Those are kinds of diversity, but they don't get very deep if you're kind of demanding everybody be on more or less the same ideological page regarding LGBT ideology, especially given that certain elements of LGBT ideology do not have history in their favor, do not have the facts in their favor. And this is largely operating almost with a cult mentality, not necessarily all the controlling forces at every level, but it has the features of a social contagion, using pressure tactics to make people agree whether they really agree or not under threat of force. Also, a lot of it is trying to reach people through messaging and populism, rather than saying, here, I want you to think through this. I want you to understand it. Ask questions and we'll dialogue and come up with something together. That's what fair-minded people might do to find points of agreement. But that's not what you're finding in diversity training. It's not a dialogue. It's not about hearing from the employees. What do you think about diversity? What are your ideas for implementing more diversity? Do you think LGBT should be a kind of diversity that we focus on? Or maybe we need to focus more on political diversity. Those aren't options in diversity training. Diversity training is not about diversity. It's about conformity. And so a lot of people coming to their workplace and finding that for some reason their job is now pressuring them to go through a diversity training and they have to sign something, I would say, if you don't agree with it, don't sign it, and effectively dare them to fire you for it. But make sure that they know that you're willing to call up Alliance Defending Freedom, or I believe they're called FIRE, F-I-R-E. I forget what it stands for, but they support religious freedom and freedom of speech. And let them know that you're going to have these lawyers on speed dial if this business or corporation's willing to fire you for not lining up with ideology that has nothing to do with the product or service that they're offering.
It's really interesting in the last few years where things have come, and maybe it's just because people are on social media, that is just another way where conversation isn't really about, like you said, a dialogue, and people can't even talk about, you know, different evidence that you could bring or different arguments that you'd want them to consider. It is all very fascinating. And I just want to ask, you know, that's the employee side of things. So what about the consumers of these products and services? Can we just boycott all the corporations marketing pride products, or, you know, as in Garnier's case, saying that they embrace pride 365 days a year? So do we give up our, you know, some people, their favorite shampoo might be Fructis, or they use Garnier hair color. The other question in the past was, it used to be on the other, the shoe on the other foot, right? Before, I guess, even Chick-fil-A has entered the fray with pride. But before that, they were known for being closed on Sundays. And then they actually had people from the queer community boycotting them, showing demonstrations and things like that, because they thought they were a conservative Christian corporation with roots. And so they were saying, everyone boycott Chick-fil-A. And then all the Christians went to Chick-fil-A. So how can we, it's like head spinning. How do we decide? And, you know, we can apply it to other things. Like, people may know that Marriotts are owned by Mormon companies. And in Christian apologetics, we, you know, are often asked, are Mormons Christians? And we can show you from their teachings that they're not Christian, although they like to be put into that category. And so It would be hard to, I mean, there's a lot of hotels these days. I guess you could boycott Marriott's, where they have the Book of Mormon and the Bible in your nightstand drawer there. But can we seriously, with every company, and some of these smaller companies are really subsidiaries of larger companies that are embracing this. So how, as a consumer, do we navigate this? I mean, we need to buy stuff. We need to buy shampoo to wash our hair, you know?
Mm-hmm. I would say, similar to at the employee level, at the consumer level, don't assume you can run from this problem. The options to run from it are getting fewer and fewer, to where everywhere you turn, there's someone pressuring you with LGBT messaging. And secondary to that, critical race theory and related critical theory messaging. As you are deliberating about your consumer or employee options, put your faith first and your family second before your own comfort before your own interests, put your faith first and family second, and everything else comes after that. And then I would also say, recognize the spiritual warfare going on here. When you realize you are at war, you stop walking around in that field like it's a walk in a park, and you start running like you're in a football game or like you're in combat, to be more explicit, because spiritual warfare isn't a metaphor. It's literal. We are in spiritual warfare. It's just the masks have come off and you're seeing more clearly what's at stake right now. So because it's spiritual warfare going on, you have to think like a soldier. You have to think in terms of what you're buying and where you're working. Think like a soldier. Is this going to advance the cause that I believe in? Is this going to give the enemy ground? And so with that in mind, you can't really boycott every woke corporation out there. That's too impractical, unless you have the means for subsistence living and you do have a good tract of land and you're able to live off the grid. If you can pull that off, fantastic. We probably need more folks that can do that. But it's, for the most part, it's too pervasive to avoid and boycott all woke corporations. You still can boycott some. Your money is still your voice and your vote. It's not all of your voice, but it is a voice of yours and it's your vote. And so try to, within reason, try to vote for what you believe in. Use your money towards goods and services that you believe in. Pick a few representative organizations, especially ones that you think are ideologically committed to these bad ideas. They're not just virtue signaling, they believe in it. And you can make a difference, especially when other people who are like you start doing the same thing. Potentially, if consumers get smart about this, we can turn the clock back a little bit on this whole stakeholder capitalist abuse that we're seeing in the form of ESG and corporate equality index. We can turn the clock back a little bit to the shareholders era where they had to say, hey, we still have to sell a product. And if people aren't buying, then none of this appeasement that I'm doing for all these corporate customers really amounts to anything. I need to keep my consumer level customers happy too. And so with Bud Light, we're seeing that. And now it's become a catch term. Target got Bud Lighted. They're getting the Bud Light treatment because folks are realizing just how devastatingly stupid a decision it was for Bud Light to try to expand past that frat boy culture and try to market more to the LGBT crowd when that wasn't their primary customer base. And they were going to get a lot of flack for doing it. They should have had every reason to expect that to happen. And yet they did it anyway. And if different corporations, businesses, service industries realize what kind of power the consumers can wield when they line up on something, they'll have to respect us. They'll have to respect what we do. And we don't have to be violent. We don't have to be mean-spirited. We don't have to compromise our testimony. We're just being strategic in how we vote with our voice and with our money.
Nearing the end of this podcast, I have one more question for you. So our listeners might be thinking, this is overwhelming, very much doom and gloom. I feel completely paralyzed. I don't know where to shop. Can I eat anymore? Can I even buy groceries? I won't even know, you know, which brands of stuff that I'm buying cereal are embracing diversity or not. And just on any of this activism. So what do you see from a Christian perspective that is actually encouraging? And are there any hopeful themes that you're seeing in all this corporate, you know, very aggressive activism, especially mostly on the whole pride front? So is there anything positive that's come out of this past month?
Well, to answer the first part of your question, I think it's 2 Corinthians chapter 1 that talks about we do not grieve as the world grieves, because we grieve anchored in hope and joy in Christ, because all that's going wrong in the world will ultimately, eventually be made right. And so whatever despair we might be feeling, if that despair outweighs our hope and our joy in Christ, then we're losing faith. We're compromising in our own spiritual integrity there, because we do have a future hope that can buoy even the darkest of fears and disconcertedness we might be feeling. Besides that, you might say, theological answer, I see some practical signs of hope. You can only force feed people so long before they start throwing up. And I think that's what we're starting to see at a consumer level. And media is starting to pick up on that. And there's a groundswell that is indeed organic, is indeed grassroots level, where people are pushing back against this stuff. For example, linguistic theft and all the propagandist messaging trying to demonize everything that is right-wing, conservative, Christian, and traditional, trying to treat free speech like it's some dog whistle for white supremacy, trying to relabel disagreement to just equal hate, or truth-telling is violence, or encouraging people to have to take personal responsibility. Well, that's oppression. Well, all of that stuff, that language game starts to lose its mystifying power when people start to recognize the lying pattern going on behind it and start to say, hey, you just called me a hateful bigot, a white supremacist who's trying to deny your existence. I have to ask, what do you mean by any of those? And I can say for myself that I love you and I want you to flourish in life. And I don't think encouraging you with deceptive pronouns is ultimately to your benefit. I care too much about you to use false pronouns that are going to help concretize you in a mistaken ideology. Now, if you're willing to put up with my disagreement, I would love to stay a friend in your life because I do care about you. And all the stuff you might be accusing me of, I know it's false, but you're entitled to believe whatever you want to believe. I am interested in what those words mean, and here, let's have that conversation. So when you can carry yourself with poise, dignity, pushing through the language games, and not flinch when people accuse you of everything, always with Hitler's involved, of course, because you're a Nazi if you're not on my side. When you're unfazed by all of those language games and you express your genuine concern for people, you can weather a lot of those storms. And I think there are people who are picking up on that. And so they're starting to vomit the rainbow back up because they were tired of being force-fed. Another sign of hope, I think, is we're seeing lawsuits owing to bad medicine, ideologically driven healthcare choices that hospitals are making for the sake of their healthcare equality index. And now they're starting to reap the repercussions of it as, 18-year-olds who had surgery when they were 16 are saying, hey, I'm not any better. I'm actually much worse off. And you are playing party to this to help do this harm to me. Why did you do that, given that all your bioethics committees up till about 5 minutes ago would have said, don't do any sexual reassignment surgery for anybody, much less minors, because it's amputating healthy limbs, it's scarifying and stripping other limbs, it's dooming me to a lifetime of antibiotics to prevent infection from this open wound, which you're telling me is now female genitalia, but it's not because my body keeps wanting to heal it back up. So it makes urinating painful. It makes it so that I'm infertile, makes it so that I'm incontinent and can't stop the dripping the rest of the day. All of these things are significant handicaps that I didn't have before you took a knife to me. So I'm suing. So there are a lot of these lawsuits starting to crop up as people are no longer falling for the mystifying language and ideology of LGBT thought. Also, there's about 20 different states that have banned sexual reassignment surgery for minors. Now, they're still getting pushback at the judicial level, but at least some of these are likely to make it through and to stand. On the social media front, I think Elon Musk taking over Twitter really expose a lot of the corruption that was trying to determine the narrative and prevent dissent. We have more legitimate room for intellectual discourse about difficult, complicated ideas. What was the best way to treat COVID? What was the best way to surgically deal with people who think they're in the wrong body? And you don't have to be run off and tarred and feathered because you think cutting off healthy limbs is bad for kids. Also, and I think it's hard to overestimate just how important this is. And I'm not talking about all of Christianity here. I do think the facts are on our side, but let's peel that back and just focus on just being a mere Christianity realist about how things are, about how tradition works, about how human beings are. The facts are on our side. The facts are on our side, and that will win out eventually. It takes time, though, because the delusion can last for generations sometimes, where people are deeply committed to bad ideas. But the facts are on our side in terms of the gender binary, and it shows up in traditional gender roles that work really well when you've got two mutually loving and respectful people that are taking care of each other in a healthy marriage. They have the ability to reproduce in a way that no lesbian couple and no gay couple can. Our birth rates are better for those that ascribe to broadly traditional marital roles. Our survivability, our viability in society is stronger than those who are committed to an ideology that's telling them everything is a social construct and that everything you don't like is a white supremacist and Nazis, and just deluding them with a bunch of oversimplified narratives. The reality is that there's a lot of nuance to be worked through here, and we need a free speech environment to be able to have the kinds of discussions where we can get wiser, we can learn from each other, and we can have an actual civilization, because you can't have civilization without civility. You can't. That's the root concept of civilization, is to be civil. And we have to be able to have that civility to be able to last another generation. And folks who are learning those things by accounting for how things are, not just how they want things to be in terms of their ideology, they're tremendously empowered. And in that sense, I think the facts are on our side. And that's a huge sign of encouragement for our side. But I don't even think of it as sides. I think we're just trying to be on the side of truth and reality.
Well, this has been a very provocative conversation for really in-depth on this topic of corporate diversity training and pride emphasis. So finally, on a much lighter note, I have a fun question for John. We've been talking about corporations all this podcast. So what was your first real job?
My first real job.
That you worked for maybe a corporation.
I worked at Carowinds, which is a theme park on the North and South Carolina border. That first year, what did I do? I think I was in games. So all those games, you know, one ball milk can and peach basket toss and throwing the rings around the milk cans and things like that. I worked in the games area of Carowinds, one of the regions. You know, it's broken up into different little themed areas. The next year, that was my first job three times over, because I stayed at Carowinds three summers. I did games, I did rides, and I did the water park. So yeah.
Well, that sounds fun. Well, thanks, John, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate being here.
You've been listening to episode 345 from the Postmodern Realities podcast and the Christian Research Journal, which is now morphing into an online magazine that is free for everyone to read. However, this special last print issue for our journal, volume 46, number 1 and 2, is only available for those who make a partner gift with us in the month of June 2023 for the Christian Research Journal, and you can partner with us at equip.org. You won't want to miss John's feature-length article in this very special and last print issue of the Christian Research Journal, and his article is called How to Keep Your Job Without Losing Your Soul, a Survival Guide for Diversity Training. Stay connected with the Christian Research Institute and all the new content we have coming your way. The best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. There you will find thousands of free resources right at your fingertips, from articles to video to audio, and it's all for free. You'll find our podcasts hosted there, as well as the Bible Answer Man broadcast, which is hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and streams live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to
Hank Unplugged, which is the podcast of Hank Hanegraaff. And in that podcast, he has really in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. And in addition, he has a new series on his podcast feed called Hank Unplugged Shorts, which Hank goes into the headlines in the mainstream media and refutes a lot of those cultural issues that we have in these short podcast episodes. And there's quite a few of them. You don't want to miss out on them. Now, if you want to find some of this at other places where it's all in one place, really subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a great way to get all of our content there, our podcasts there, and different individual questions theologically that people have that Hank answers at our YouTube channel. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't know how to subscribe to YouTube. I don't have a YouTube account. Well, actually, you might just have a YouTube account. If you have a Gmail address, you have a YouTube account. Just log into YouTube with your Gmail address and search for Bible Answer Man channel, and please become one of our subscribers. In addition, if you see that bell icon right there on our front page, please click that, and every time that we have new content, you will receive a notification that new content is up on our channel for you to be able to consume. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute. We are grateful for you listening and reading and watching.